down the drum.
Receiving this message. We are Ken Jennings and John Roderick. We speak to you from our present, which we can only assume is your distant past, the turbulent time that was the early 21st century.
Fearing the great cataclysm that will surely befall our civilization, we began this monumental reference of strange and obscure human knowledge. These recordings represent our attempt to compile and preserve wonders and esoterica that would otherwise be lost.
So whether you're listening from an advanced civilization or have just reinvented the technology to decrypt our transmissions, this is our legacy to you.
This is our time capsule. This is the Omnibus.
You have accessed entry 774.EX3607, certificate number 18461. The Memex.
Promoting the information superhighway, Vice President Gore on Wednesday said he could foresee the day when a youngster just home from school, given a choice between Nintendo and the Encyclopedia Britannica, would choose to access the encyclopedia. If that is so, that might be even a greater accomplishment than the technology.
Now, given the fact that you
have not slept very well and you're about to do a math episode.
there will be no math. But it is computer science, which is famously something that you scorn.
I believe and something, is a trade.
And something that I disliked so much that I went to the effort of going on a game show to try to get away from it.
And yet, probably, what would you say, 30% of futurelings are computer scientists?
And a surprising number of entries in this reference work are related to the computer revolution of the century in which we were born.
Yeah.
Despite our deep suspicion and dislike of everything related to the science.
But I think futurelings are going to look back at this time and think of it in two ways, the computer revolution and the social revolution, because you came into the 20th century with a lot of habits that were
like eight wealthy white guys pretty much running everything.
Yeah. People still being pulled around in ox carts. And you came out the other side where it's like, well, you know, the world is a global place and people are completely intermixing, and also now they no longer touch or talk to each other because they all have heads up displays and they're looking at each other through Google Glass.
And people also probably talk about produce getting better.
Produce is a lot better. Yeah. Even from when we were kids.
Yeah, when we were kids there were like three fruits.
Yeah, that's right.
Do you want the mushy red apple, the mushy green apple, or the banana?
The banana.
And sometimes of the year you could get some citrus.
But bananas were better. We've covered
absolutely
that.
Oh, I have a banana in my bag right now.
Well, apples were better too. It was just they weren't good in January.
But we, this is a episode requested by a futureling named Mark, or I guess a contemporary futureling.
Thanks, Mark.
I guess everybody is in somebody's future.
Time is a flat circle.
We spoke to Mark recently. He was the former engineer who got in very early on a fairly evil tech company. And through that success was able to, well, I don't know what, he retires in sales or something.
He doesn't retire in sales.
Right. But he didn't retire from sales like our parents and grandparents did.
He's a sailor. He's a Northwesterner.
He's a Northwester?
He's a Norwester. But no, he lives here in Seattle and he's actually only one kiss away from me, right? He is close friends with someone that I'm close friends with. So I'd heard of him. I'd heard tell of him, but
we spoke to him, giving him his, you know, his little, his Zoom chat with us, he was in Florida for the winter, because that's where,
if you work for an evil tech company and retire at age 50,
why not? That's where the boats are. And he had gone back and forth on some show ideas he wanted to recommend. He had donated to the Patreon at a level where he could suggest a topic.
And he's super computer science.
Oh yeah. All his ideas were extremely technical, except for the ones that were about, musical theater, it turned out. It was twice in a row we had chatted with somebody in a technical field who was thinking of dumping it all for his first love, community theater.
Isn't that a futureling thing? It's like, oh, you're a computer scientist.
It really must be.
But it's not that you want to be in a rock band. It's that you want to do like a traveling version of Our Town.
If you know a certain number of C++ libraries and you know all the words to the first number of Guys and Dolls, you probably might be a futureling. like he had a suggestion about like early newsgroup culture, early '90s Usenet culture.
Right. We talked about the magazine 2600, which I intend to do an episode on.
Oh, that's right. That was your idea, not his, right?
Yeah, but I was trying to like get elicit some like hacker badinage with him. Like
you wanted to talk about phone freaking.
I did. I did. And he was like, oh yeah, I was aware of that, but not, that's not really my thing.
I think maybe he's a little, is he too young for it?
Too old. He's older than me. So he was maybe too.
You think he'd be the right age for the Captain Crunch phone era freaking hackers.
It's so fun. I just love that whole culture so much, but it's not that I ever understood it, but just the idea that you would war games somebody's
War Games Ma Bell.
Some dial-up connection and
and he finally settled on, well, when he was we were kind of batting ideas around on the call,
yeah,
and he had many thoughts about Anita Loos, who wrote I always call it Diamonds Are a Girl's Best Friend, who wrote Gentlemen Prefer Blondes,
right?
And but he also mentioned a technology name I had never heard before, I'm sorry to say, Vannevar Bush. And
this was the part of the call where I started to get very lost.
Oh yeah, you wandered off.
I was like, what?
Who? You came back with a hotter coffee and a weird hat. Looking up the life and times of Vannevar Bush, possibly one of the most influential thinkers of the 20th century, and in great omnibus fashion, mostly, even though he had a bajillion accomplishments, largely through one article in The Atlantic, which is what you want.
Of course.
You want the seminal text.
Yes, and the Atlantic ends up being the record, right? I mean,
before the omnibus.
Yeah, the Atlantic magazine is the platinum record before omnibus.
Because it's got a storied history,
It does, right? All the way back to the early, early mid 19th century.
I bet there was a newsletter called The Atlantic aboard the Mayflower. They're like, what should we call this? And they looked around.
They were like, what? What's one of the primary features here?
Have you read The New Atlantic? It's got some juicy stuff on the captain.
We saw another whale.
The cockroach count went up.
But it's one of the only magazines I still subscribe to. It, I don't know. It's just the right amount of, smart.
Vannevar Bush, before his, remarkable Atlantic article of 1945. His dates, by the way, 1890 to 1974. He died a month after my birth, and he was almost alive for, well, I don't know, Spanish-American War. Statehood of Washington. Like, that's 84 years. He saw a different world.
Those are almost exactly, that's the lifespan of my grandmother.
Ah.
She was born in 1889 and died in 1972.
It's good to cross a century. Like, that's something we're going to have when we're old.
Right.
That not everybody gets.
Oh, we remember back in the 70s.
It just means you can remember a year where the second number is different, and that impresses young people.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. I had a friend from high school write me yesterday, and she said, I'm doing graduate work on the 70s, and I want to talk to you because you remember the 70s. And I was like, I do. I do. I love to talk about the 70s.
Yeah, I'm sure you didn't resist too much.
No, no, no. I was like, thank God.
Bush was a young inventor, engineer, researcher. During World War I, he joined the National Research Council. He already had an academic job. I think he was going from maybe Tufts to MIT at the time. He joined the National Research Council to do scientific work for the war effort.
Uh-huh.
And his great discovery was a way, kind of a theoretical way of detecting submarines via changes they would make to the Earth's magnetic field. You could measure, presumably because submarines are made out of metal.
Right.
In
World War I?
In World War I. And he got it to work, but the only problem is it would only work on a wooden ship. If you tried it on a metal ship, it would, the the metal all around you would be too much noise for the signal.
Oh, you're saying that you had to be on a wooden ship.
Oh, you're not. Yeah, the submarines don't have to be made of wood.
Yeah, I was like, how would a wooden ship
at the time? Using wooden submarines, as right. You know, just oak and yeah. Or you know, a really fancy one of teak.
The Merrimack. They were using the Merrimack.
Even Captain Nemo did not have a wooden submarine.
But you had to be on a wood ship, which was increasingly rare.
Otherwise, the iron floor and hull beneath you. Wait, ships don't have floors. They have...
hulls.
Well, but what's between you and the... stand on the hull. The deck. Exactly, the deck.
The deck, thank you.
The iron of the deck and the hull below you.
I'm glad to be able to contribute to this episode.
You knew what... I guess I should have known. It turned out there was a Star Trek way to know this.
Army hardies.
After World War One, he... in 1922, with a... two or three other MIT, he was on the faculty at MIT, he was teaching there, and along with some other MIT smarty pantses, he founded two companies that year. One, the Spencer Thermostat Company, which
that sounds very 1920,
which two mergers later became Texas Instruments.
What?
Yeah, it was one of the predecessor companies to Texas Instruments.
Wow.
The same year he founded, a collaborator? No, that makes it sound like he's a
co-founder.
Spy. Yeah, a cohort, a comrade. No, a.
Yeah, I mean, you can be a collaborator and not a spy.
But it's not the right word.
You and I are collaborators.
It's not the word I want. A colleague.
Colleague. That's a good.
What were you going to say?
It was going to start with a C. Whatever it was, I was going to say.
A colleague had invented a new kind of rectifier called the S tube. You know, just a new kind of electrical device.
Right.
And so he and two other cohorts.
Sure. Colleagues.
Colleagues, collaborators. Caligulas. Two other Caligulas founded the American Appliance Company to use this new rectifier to make silent refrigerators.
Oh, nice.
Think about the problem of the 1920s. If your refrigerator, I guess, is burning propane or natural gas or something. Like today when the fridge cuts on, you might get a little jump when it goes. But back then it would sound like a chainsaw.
The refrigerator in my house is absolutely from 1979, speaking of the 70s. And when it clicks on, I cannot tell it apart from the furnace. Like something goes on in the house and it's just like, rrr.
Our children will never know. Our microwave yesterday started making vibrating at a slightly different pitch. I don't know if the dish is a little off or it's set into the cupboard differently, but it sounds a little bit lower, I think. Uh-huh. And my kids were acting like there was a poltergeist. What is going on? We have to call someone. I think it's just making microwave noise. Anyway, within a few months, they have changed direction on their plan to put a silent refrigerator in every kitchen, and the American Appliance Company becomes Raytheon.
Wow.
In the space of a few months, this guy founded Raytheon and a predecessor to Texas Instruments.
Wow.
He spends the next decade teaching at MIT in addition, and watching his, I'm sure watching his bottom line grow because he is now a founder of two big machine companies.
Right, although this is pre... venture capital, so neither one of them was worth $1 billion.
Each of them had tossed in $550, and they were crossing their fingers.
Right.
He built a very early analog computer. In the 20s. He's building a...
like a mechanical computer?
Yes. It was a kind of differential analyzer, which is a way to use very complicated arithmetic methods to find answers to calculus problems, to differential equations. And that's something that becomes too hard for humans as the equations become higher order. But, with a bunch of cogs and gears.
You can make an electric slide rule, basically.
Yeah, exactly. You can automate some of that. By 1932, he was the dean of the engineering school. And then he's so prestigious, he has a national profile. He joins various Washington, D.C., quasi-governmental, this is before the military-industrial complex, which he is about to essentially invent.
Right. Started Raytheon.
But he becomes a big wig at a lot of these Washington, D.C. scientific institutions.
Right. He's a DARPA.
Yeah. The predecessor to DARPA. He actually is the second chairperson of NACA, which is the predecessor of NASA. There was no space to give us an S in the late 1930s.
I love him, but I'm terrified to hear what's next.
Oh yeah, what's your guess?
Guided missiles?
Tuskegee Airmen? It could be anything at this point.
Right.
Guided missiles is actually quite close. Because as, no spoilers, but by this time, World War II is about, you know, seems inevitable.
Good old World War II.
It was not yet called World War II.
Here we are again.
And he, like every person of his generation, was remembering the lessons of the first war. And he,
turns out they weren't really.
In this case, he learned, you know, maybe this is the secret of his success. He learned a correct lesson, which was the coordination between the military and actual scientists had been terrible.
Oh.
And in his opinion, it had cost lives. It had lengthened the war. And, you know, because he's, you know, his name is Van Ivar. I assume he's from a good New England family.
Right. He's a former Dutch colonial family.
Look at this. The son of a universalist pastor from Everett, Massachusetts. It's exactly what you want.
Perfect.
And as a result, he knows Frederick Delano, the uncle to the president.
Oh, well played.
So unlike a lot of these guys on the, you know, I'm sure a lot of these people on these boards are all East Coast elites.
Right.
I would not be surprised in the 20s and 30s.
That's right.
But he has, you know, he can get a meeting with FDR. So he goes into the, I was about to say the Oval Office, but is that right in 1940?
Yes. Oval Office, yes.
Yes. Yeah, in fact, it's a couple presidencies in, right?
Yeah, they moved the big desk over.
He has a single sheet of paper on which he has outlined...
they didn't move. You know, the Resolute desk, I don't think, was in the Oval Office until Kennedy. Is that right? It was in some other room. It was in some room upstairs.
And not every president since has used the Resolute desk. I think we got in trouble once for saying some president was at the Resolute desk, and we got letters saying, Ford and Reagan used the Resolute. Carter used the Indomitable.
Sure, a folding table.
Yeah, he used a ping pong table, but he took down the net when he had guests.
So our man determined that in World War I, although scientists were saying one thing, we should use tube-driven rectifiers.
Right. Silent refrigerators.
The army in the field was hooking up their tanks to horses, and that was now he was going to make the difference.
And this shouldn't surprise anybody who's familiar with the officer class of the army,
right,
that they do not want a bunch of eggheads
coming
in and telling them how to do their job.
They fight the last war, Ken, every time.
And I'm an expert here because I can do a voice from a movie.
Yeah.
Of a...
get up, you maggots!
Some kind of hidebound officer.
Right.
Who doesn't want to hear what the eggheads in Washington think? So it's probably accurate. So he has a single sheet of paper saying, look, there should be some oversight group. This should all be coordinated through the executive branch. Then it should go down through the secretaries of the Army and Navy. Basically, what he's saying is someone, and he's the one holding the paper, should be running science for the military.
Well, you know, this became a trope, right? If there's a certain, era of World War II movie, at least, where... You go to some Washington, you know, some anonymous Washington office building where girls in, you know, in pencil skirts with Andrew's sister's haircuts are bustling around carrying files and
decoding secret things.
Yeah, right. There's machine learning happening.
Yes, tapes are whirring somewhere. That's exactly right. Stanley Tucci is making Captain America.
That's right. This would have been pre-tapes whirring, I think.
That's true. What would you have instead? Would you even have...
Tubes.
No.
Just tubes illuminating, right? They're throbbing.
Things are blinking. That's right. Nothing is turning yet.
Right.
We haven't yet determined that science can make things rotate. You'd think rotating would have been first.
Yes.
But instead, there was blinking, then rotating.
Well, there were like metal cylinders that were rotating.
That's true. They had wax cylinders.
Automobile.
They said things like... I'm just imagining them all talking in an FDR voice, even if it's not FDR.
Ah, we need to.
This nation must not fall behind on the science of the atom. Everybody always said the atom, like there was only one. And if we could just discover it.
The atom.
And that was true back then. You know, science was a matter of not enough information. The problem was we didn't know what molecules were made of. We didn't know what caused polio. And that's all about to change.
We had separated the gases, right?
Yay.
We knew what gases were.
A bunch of French people in the 18th century had given weird names to gases, which right. later became the good names.
But still in 1939, we did not understand what a molecule was.
Well,
is that right?
No, that's not true. But okay. You know, but how the atom reacts, you know, the structure of the atom, competing theories are still going.
Right.
And now it's all actually very urgent because... both sides of the war think that nuclear fission is
right.
possible.
The Nazis are up separating heavy water in some Norwegian fjord.
The British, the Americans, and the Germans all have competing experimental physicists exploring the weapons potential of atomic energy.
Isn't that incredible?
And this is what Bush wants to get in on the ground floor of. So he gives FDR this piece of paper saying, I mean, this meeting is not an Einstein-like meeting about the atom, but it's got to be foremost in people's minds in 1940.
And this is, because we credit that Einstein letter with being the thing that attracted the president and the political class to the idea that we needed to get ahead of this or the Germans would get ahead of it. I've never understood why every one of these theoretical physicists, why they were all from Germany. Like, we had three competing programs, but they'd all gone to the University of Heidelberg somehow.
In some cases, the common bond may be Judaism.
Yeah, right.
Like, these were the people that could, they would have been building a bomb in Germany, except that the Germans had decided otherwise,
right,
in violent fashion. So this is, the letter from Einstein, I guess, is the summer of 39. So this is now about a year later. And so Einstein has approved lots of scientific weaponry initiatives, but there's no centralization.
There's no Oppenheimer.
Yeah, well, there probably is.
There was an Oppenheimer,
yes, but he is not the Oppenheimer. And in fact, Bush was the, if you're thinking of Oppenheimer as the centralized guy that all this runs through, Bush turns out to be the Oppenheimer. Because even though he's not a big name, like the actual like physicist, the Teller and the Oppenheimer.
Big name now. Yeah.
Right. Bush at the time was a big name. He was on the cover of Time magazine in 1944. FDR only needs 15 minutes to say, yes, you're absolutely right. We are doing this wrong. He writes, okay, FDR, on the proposal, which I guess is...
That's it.
That's the equivalent of Trump's button that gets the Diet Coke or whatever. Okay, FDR. And suddenly, Vannevar Bush is essentially the unofficial lead science advisor of the executive branch going into World War II. Suddenly, he is the chairman of what gets created, the National Defense Research Committee, which within a year has become rebranded as the Office of Scientific Research and Development. And it stays the OSRD throughout World War II. And that is Bush's purview.
Absolutely. DARPA. It's 100%, has to be the forerunner.
Yes, yeah. This is the beginning. And he's doing it all from scratch. He's actually calling in meetings with the Secretary of the Army and the Secretary of the Navy and saying, hey, what if you listened to scientists and we gave you good stuff?
Uh-huh.
The Army is kind of for it. He's friends with Stimson. The Navy guy is a more hard-bitten admiral type who doesn't want to hear it.
Of course. So battleships will win the war.
Exactly. So throughout the war, he is constantly, trying to cajole the Navy, but good stuff is coming out of it. He turns out he's a genius at navigating all these bureaucracies.
Yeah.
Maybe more so than any actual science he does, but he creates a radar. He sees the potential of radar and creates a lab just to work on new kinds of radar.
Which absolutely did affect the war.
Yes. That's where the U.S.'s airborne and mobile radar technology comes from. And using that technology, he also oversaw the group that created the proximity fuse. Which I had never thought of, but that's a huge part of winning the war.
Sure, of course.
If you have radar, you think of somebody on the ground detecting planes coming in. But what if a projectile, what if a shell could actually use radar to determine when it was close to the thing it was going to hit?
And it didn't have to hit it. It could just blow up next to it.
It knew when it was close enough to blow up.
That's amazing.
And because the U.S. had, including Bush, had been kind of skeptical of rocketry, the Germans were all in on rocketry, and the U.S. thought those guys were crackpots, and that's why they had the V-1 and the V-2, and we were like, wah, wah, wee, wah. Yeah, we were like, uh-oh, basically. And so that's why London gets blown up for years.
Right.
And, and eventually towards the end of the war, Germany's perfecting rockets that could cross the Atlantic.
Right.
So suddenly we care a little more. Suddenly it's not pubs anymore.
And the proximity fuse, all of this is the same sort of magnetic field stuff.
Oh, yeah. I guess that's related to his submarine stuff.
Yeah.
I wouldn't have thought about that. But he convinces the army that this proximity fuse is the way to go. And in fact, it's the only thing we can use to narrow that rocket gap.
The rocket gap.
Because we don't have rockets, but we could blow them up with this. Right. And it works.
There's a precious bodily fluids gap.
Towards the... But yes, they did not tap his essence.
Right.
But by the end of the war, I think like 44-ish, the army is using this new proximity fuse against German rockets and ground targets, because, you know,
right,
you can
half the time
your stuff,
half the time your bomb ends up buried 30 feet under the Berlin streets instead of like air exploding. Well, and that ended up, of course, the little boy and fat man.
There could be a bunker under there.
Fat boy and little man.
Well, so that's the other thing. He oversees the Manhattan Project. Like, that's the, that's his third great scientific accomplishment of the war.
Well done.
And he is the guy. He goes to Trinity. He goes to Alamogordo to watch the tests.
He oversees it as like top administrator.
Yes. He's the liaison between the White House and the actual scientists, Oppenheimer and Teller and the names, you know, Feynman.
So those guys are just up there on a plateau, with test tubes. It's really Bush that's pulling the strings.
Yeah. And those, and he's doing a lot of hard work.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, today we glamorize the scientists, and rightly so, but he's the one trying to get the right, the ear of the right military officers. And, you know, early in the war, there's appropriations problems. You know, the difference between the NDRC and the OSRD is that one did not have a congressional budget.
One had an N in it.
That's true.
Well, this is the thing that's always amazing about that program is that, and that's never been clear to me, is how did they build the, I mean, they took over an entire town in Tennessee, put a fence around it, and was like, well, we're doing something else here now.
That was,
and
Bush's call, by the way. Bush is the reason why Oak Ridge was Oak Ridge.
Yeah, I can only imagine. How did they build Hanford? How did they build Los Alamos? Like, they had to, that was just, I mean, just the fencing costs alone.
And nothing turns on a dime like government and military expenditure.
Yeah. It sure as heck wasn't Oppenheimer filling out all those requisition forms.
No, the scientists would have been terrible at that.
Yeah.
Feynman's playing bongos and probably using using those forms to light a crazy cigar.
Right.
I was going to say doobie, but it was probably a cigar.
No, it was a cigar at the time. They weren't smoking doobies yet.
They weren't smoking marijuana with an H.
But he was, yeah, he was, you know, banging the cocktail waitress two at a time.
And Bush is a celebrity for it. He's on the, you know, the cover of Time. People know that he's our egghead that's going to beat the Nazis.
Wow.
And in July 1945, with the war wrapping up, you know, the Germans have surrendered. We are, although the general public doesn't know it, a few months away from Hiroshima and Nagasaki. He publishes in The Atlantic an essay called As We May Think, which is, it already has some kind of beautiful kind of pulp science fiction short story title.
Right. English as she is spoke.
But to me, it sounds like the future, you know, as like as we may think, you know, I don't know if it's actually the four words that appear in order in Blake or Milton, but it sounds like
Asimov-y.
Yeah, right. It sounds like kind of the fake poetry of the pulps.
Yeah.
And it really conveys the future to me in a very 40s and 50s kind of way. And The Atlantic publishes it, and The Atlantic really hypes up this essay. Like, in the introduction, they say, this is the biggest thing since The American Scholar, in quotes, which was the famous address that Emerson gave to the Phi Beta Kappa Society at Harvard in the 1830s.
Just envisioning the future of being an intellectual.
Right. And in his case, the American intellectual, like the old, it was one of these kind of, I'm going to say this is an epical moment things like right. We do on Omnibus twice a week, where he says the old European ways have failed. This is a new nation. With new transcendental insights, you know, the gifts that nature bestows upon us and our, you know, our philosophical brains and, you know, we have all these advantages and we can get rid of these old habits and traditions and create a new kind of knowledge.
Basically. Our scientists don't have to speak French.
Yes. They don't speak Latin, but they can go out and look at chestnut trees.
Yes.
And somehow that will convey, I read The American Scholar in college, and it was never really clear to me that he did define the 19th century in any appreciable way.
But the 19th century in America was defining itself, right? Every single day there was like a new gizmo.
And the mystique is a huge part of that. So him just saying, guess what? It's an American century, bitches.
Yeah.
Like that, that works.
Right.
You know, the universe manifested that because Emerson told Harvard that it was. So this is how the Atlantic hypes As We May Think.
And which is a thinking document,
it's not an invention.
Yeah.
It's not a schematic or a blueprint, although later it's reprinted with an illustration because it does come with, we're finally going to get to the topic. It does come with an idea for a hypothetical invention, the Memex, but this is not something he's invented or indeed that people could invent. It's something that he has thought of in his head and thinks, I don't know how we're going to do this, but we need this object.
It's quantum computing.
Yes, but on a very, very primitive level. It's still furniture, basically. Uh-huh. But he's like, this is the furniture of the future. Uh-huh. He starts the essay by saying, look, we can all see the war's about to end. He does not say, because I've invented the atomic bomb, although it's hard to read it now without seeing that at the end of every sentence. And what's next for science? For biology, stuff hasn't changed much. But what are physicists going to do now that they've just spent 10 years on weapons? You know, what's their problem? And as you said, because he was not a great engineer or researcher himself, but he was just an ingenious coordinator of research and engineering, he sees a problem that nobody else has seen. He is the first guy looking at this horizon of information overload.
Huh.
For the first time, the problem is not that we don't know how many electrons there are in this nucleus, or we don't know which of these sera will cure this disease. The problem really is there's too much to know. And how is just a, but we're still using the old methods. We're still paging through paper journals,
right,
to try to navigate this. And that is the wrong way to do it.
I you've surely heard the apocryphal story of, and it may not be apocryphal, but I remember the first time I visited Palo Alto, I heard some story. I was at some fraternity party, but you know, at Stanford, this is what they talk about at fraternity
parties. I was picturing you touring apparently a lab. You were not touring a lab.
No, I was, you know, I was playing Ultimate against the Stanford Ultimate team, which was, you know, not, it was not an authorized Ultimate team. But I remember someone telling me that there was this incredible moment where the lunchroom in the biology campus was closed for renovations, and so the biologists had to use the lunchroom in the physics department, and all of a sudden biologists and physicists were sitting at the same lunch tables, and as a result of just that, all these new discoveries were made, because someone would say, like, well, I'm working on this, and the person, you know, sitting across the metal tray from them was like, huh, that sounds kind of like what I'm doing. And just the forced just proximity.
Yeah. Cross-pollination.
Yeah. So is it something like that, where, how do we deal with information overload? You have to put experts together?
It's funny that you say that. I'm always very skeptical when I hear business thinkers say work from home will always fail because you need people bumping into each other in the hall,
right,
and saying, what you working on, Susan? Yeah, I guess, you know, in interdisciplinary ways, maybe I just never had a job where I was, you know, I was never the smart enough person with smart enough people to have those sparks.
Yeah, but
maybe at a ingenious startup idea, maybe that kind of stuff does happen.
It just seems like at a certain point, biologists were down to, molecular biologists were down to molecules, and physicists were down to molecules.
He doesn't talk a lot about cross-disciplinary stuff in the article. What he does say is that each field now has generated a corpus so huge that you can't, and he doesn't limit it to the sciences. You know, even lawyers and historians have no efficient way to get to the knowledge they need to.
That's been my experience.
To argue a case or to make a pattern is this what you're saying when you, every time you've tried to hire a contractor or.
Well, it does seem, well, and in particular right now in the social sciences, it seems like we have to keep rediscovering concepts, because there's not like a collected, there's not an agreement about what constitutes the corpus, right?
And it's so far flung. It really is. I was joking, but it really is hard to overstate how much this was just like 8 well-born white guys.
Right.
Doing all this work. And now that it's happening on 6 continents, you know, there's...
Who gets the Nobel Prize?
There's a lot of logistical issues. And he's a guy who sees everything logistically. He writes, man has built a civilization so complex that he needs to mechanize his records more fully if he is to push his experiment to the logical conclusion. I think he means the human experiment. And not merely become bogged down partway there by overtaxing his limited memory.
oh, this just feels like the utopian version of the internet that keeps breaking my heart.
This is absolutely the utopian version of the internet. Because in this paper, the World Wide Web is born, even though it's 1945 and we're still 50 years away almost from Tim Berners-Lee.
But he just sees it as a huge set of file cabinets.
Basically. So, and he says this in the paper. He's like, look, Leibniz and Babbage all designed computers they couldn't build. I'm going to, because they didn't have the parts.
All right.
But they knew the principles that would work. I'm going to tell you the principles that will lead to the Memex, even though I cannot build a Memex. And again, he knows the stakes here are quite high because he has seen what has come out of scientific progress, but also the downsides of it. You know, we haven't had Hiroshima yet, but he's aware of the devastating potential and the hope, you know, the both sides of the coin of whatever the next scientific paradigm is.
Right. Well, he recognizes now that you can weaponize things that aren't intrinsically weapons.
But despite that, he never seems to apply that to his, again, this utopian knowledge of the proto-internet he's about to describe. Huh. He says, you know, look, miniaturization is coming. Everything's getting smaller and better. So we can just assume that everything's going to continue to get smaller and better.
He sees the transistor before it's
He doesn't know that there's going to be transistors and eventually microchips, but he sees the trend.
Yeah.
Because that's the kind of genius he is. Look what a telephone switchboard was 20 years ago, and look at it now. He keeps bringing up telephone. What do you call this? The center of the whatever the hub is.
What is that? That's switchboard. No.
Exchange.
Is there that right?
Yeah,
exchange.
Like he's seen how telephone exchanges have changed in a lot. And look, now we've got television. This thing is sending 16 images a second, and they're pretty good.
Deal with that.
Yeah. So he sees that this is a trend of speed and complexity and smallness is coming. And interestingly, he brings it to bear on photography. He says, look, it used to be that to make a photograph, an image, you would need a bunch of monks, and then you would need a guy with a chemical bath, even in the age of photography. But now for the first time, we have efficient, dry photography. Imagine if that got so small that you could essentially be wearing, he kind of envisions a Google Glass type thing, where a person is wearing a spectacles where he can just, you know, hit a button and every page in a journal that he looks at becomes an image recorded somewhere with some kind of Xerox-like technology, you know, a capacitance charge on some kind of flat surface.
Right.
So without a stinky chemical bath, we now have the first ability to make images and from TV broadcast them.
He foresaw East German spy technology of the 1980s.
That's exactly right. But he's seeing our world, but with his stone knives and bearskins.
Right.
You know, he's seeing a world where, Do you do this? Like, I had a cell phone for about a year before I realized that one of my main use cases for it was just literally taking a picture of physical text, you know, taking a picture of a map before I went on a hike, or taking a picture of a recipe before the card went away, or a menu outside a restaurant. I mean, do you use your phone to receipts? I do this all the time.
I never do.
Huh.
And I know it's a use case of phones, because now at the trailhead of hiking trails, there's always a sign under the map that says, take a picture
of
this map.
Take a picture.
And I always look at it and go, I don't need to take a picture of that map, because I spent my whole life looking at a map and knowing.
I had to retrain myself.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then, of course, I get out on the trail and I'm like, well, wait a minute, which way was the falls? And I'm like, oh, I didn't take a picture.
It got to the point where if I'm researching something in a library, I used to be like, where's the copy machine? And I had an iPhone. Wow. Like, you have the copy machine. So
you do a lot more library research than I do, let's be honest.
I'm the American scholar.
Yeah.
You're out in nature like Emerson would have wanted.
That's right. I'm the Thoreau of this podcast.
So he says with, he correctly predicts that miniaturization and image capture is going to be a thing. He doesn't predict digitization. You know, he doesn't predict that this will all be stored on ones and zeros somewhere, because that doesn't exist yet.
Right. And amazing what a leap that would have been to then make that stuff. He's trying to figure out a way to make it searchable.
Yes.
But not he doesn't foresee that.
He has no idea what
it's data.
The word database will not be coined until 1960.
Whoa.
He does, none of the things that allow us to have access to this stuff, they're all decades away, but he has figured out a way to do it with, by incrementally advancing stuff he has. So let's say you use that microfilm, you know, image capture. You miniaturize the image into essentially microfilm. You could put the Encyclopedia Britannica on a matchbook. And this is mind-blowing stuff in the mid-40s.
Right.
You could put a university library of a million volumes in one end of a desk.
That still is the way we described computerization even unto the 80s, right?
Yes, like,
it's amazing.
This isn't a world book, but it's on a CD-ROM.
I mean, we still try to contextualize our miniaturization by saying, they put a man on the moon,
right?
And you have that, you know, that's on your Facebook page.
When I talk about Watson, the IBM Jeopardy computer, you know, I will say, when I tell people that it has 1.8 working, 18 terabytes of memory, 1.21, I think it had 18 terabytes of working memory or something.
Yeah.
And what I say is, you know, that's the order of magnitude you would need to store every word in the Library of Congress. And then people can understand what 18 terabytes is. Like,
right.
Like we're still using the, so it seems like he's just using a metaphor.
What's a teraflop while we're here?
We're not doing that.
Okay, sorry.
It's a measure of, well.
How many flops?
Computing speed and power.
Oh, yeah. I see.
Tera is the, well.
Sure.
You know the tera.
I know what a tera is. Yeah, it's the flops I didn't know.
So you think he's, when he says you could put a university library on one end of a desk, you think he's making a philosophical point? No, he is about to describe the desk. He's like,
is he inventing a jukebox here?
Basically, it is a jukebox. And he also is thinking about user interface stuff. He's like, have you seen this vocoder where you put in text and it knows how to make sound come out? You know, it's essentially a very primitive speech synthesizer.
It makes a Neil Young record.
You can still hear a vocoder on, you know, Peter Frampton records.
Right,
or
Cher.
And also the stenotype. It was the early days of stenography, automated stenography. And he was like, you know, you could combine those, and suddenly you've got text to speech and speech to text. And he is blowing people's minds in the Atlantic in 1945.
Because this all sounds like science fiction, which is also exploding at this moment in time, right? Science fiction as a novel.
It's going to be space travel. There's going to be,
but he's actually laying it out.
And he's saying what the steps are going to be. And he even says, look, logic and arithmetic are going to get faster and automated. So there's going to be, you know, he kind of waves his hand at the fact that there's going to be computing, basically, you know, because once we can figure out how to make these analog things smaller and faster, you know, we'll be able to automate tasks that you think of as brain information tasks.
I feel like this is something that you and I are both great at, which is waving our hand at a set of ideas and going, this is all going to be a thing. We don't know how, but you can just see that it's coming.
I don't know if I'm actually that good at abstract stuff like that.
I think that's what I do. I sit and go over here, just don't worry about it. But this is going to be real, so get ready.
And he gets people's heads around it by saying, look, imagine what a department store would be like if you had this invisible back end, this desk that, you know, every time a sale is made, can tell accounting, it can tell inventory, it can tell, you know, the bean counters who want to know what to order next month.
Right.
You know, like, this could all happen at once in your department store, and nobody has to go through a paper ledger. Because, you know, this is a world where we think of, we're patting ourselves on the back about all these new business efficiencies, but all the efficiencies are just file cabinets full of paper that, as you're saying, Andrew Sisters have to poke through.
And triplicate was the big invention, right?
Yes. Now with just typing this once, you can give it to three different departments.
Right. The mimeograph.
Imagine what a chemistry lab would look like where you could, you know, all this stuff could happen automatically. Imagine a law office.
Early on in your life, did you ever work or interact with a mimeograph?
No, my teachers had a Ditto machine. And so you'd get these faded light blue worksheets.
Yeah, I actually, as a young man in our school, and when I say young man, I mean child, our school had a mimeograph.
Child is father to the man.
Yeah. But,
poor woman.
You know, my dad had file cabinets full of dictaphone tapes from, you know, from what a thing, you know,
yes,
the 60s technology of like, in the case of so-and-so and such-and-such. So I do feel like I touched the hem of this garment a little bit. My mom programmed those IBM 2466s or whatever.
I mean, we all grew up in facilities that did not yet have a computer. Our schools didn't. We went to schools that didn't have computers.
Computers still took up big buildings.
Yeah. So we remember when the problem was, and this is what Bush points out, the problem is just indexing.
Yeah.
When all that stuff is sitting in drawers in paper, you can index it one way. You can choose, hey, future people will probably want to see this alphabetically, or future people want to see this chronologically.
It's a card catalog.
Yes, but that's not, he says, that's not how memory works. That's not how the mind works. The mind is associative. The mind wants to make connections between point something at the beginning of this document and something in the middle of that one, and maybe then follow the trail to the third end of this document.
This is still the problem. This is still the, it's the problem of organizing information even now.
Yes, but he suggests that the way to solve it is, a very simple way to start solving it is with trails, where each person has their own series of links through these long text documents, so that you can, you get to one place in a document and you get a little code of dots that tells you, hey, I've either made a note here, or there's a cross-reference to a different file or a different recording. And then if your computer can read that photo cell, and then under the desk, you've got this microfiche reader. The desk, by the way, just to picture it, has a series of tilted screens up facing you, which are not CRT screens. He doesn't really get into what they would be, but you know, imagine a microfilm reader. They're probably just magnify screens, honestly.
Yeah, right.
Because you've got little tapes, little reels of microfilm under the desk that a series of literally machine gears and conveyors are loading up the right one, like a jukebox. And then the, you know, that your machine has some kind of photocell has read the dot pattern, like imagine a QR code.
Yeah.
In 1945. Knows where that link goes, brings up the right document on your next screen, and then you can see them both.
He's invented the hyperlink.
He's invented hypertext and the web browser, basically, in 1945, in desk form, in handy wooden desk form.
But you would have to limit by some methodology, by some, conceptually, you would have to limit what the microfiche was. You couldn't just have microfiche.
He says that, you know, here's what you have. You have 5,000 reels of standard text, and then you've got your own that you can record on. So, you know, using that dry photography technology, you know, the photocell in your glasses or whatever, you can also make your own snaps or recordings. And then you've got modular ones. You know, if you're a lawyer, you want to get all the case law from your state.
LexisNexis.
Yes, you know, that's the thing you add. And he never quite gets to the fact that it would be distributed, because that's just a bridge too far. Yeah. But he does say, you know, there is one point where he says something like, you know, probably from home, but not necessarily. You wouldn't have to be. Nothing here says you have to be at home. So it's clear that he can see that that's not a built-in limitation. He just doesn't know how to solve the problem of centralizing it and then distributing it.
Because he's imagining probably still a government office building in Washington, D.C., where there are 25 of these desks.
And instead of a basement full of filing cabinets, you've got everybody sitting at one of these, you know, and somebody with a cart coming around with the reels you've requested.
Yeah, right?
So yeah, and it's fun to imagine, because it is basically the World Wide Web.
Yeah.
But it's fun to imagine the World Wide Web working behind the scenes like that, with a little guy with a cart sticking in, you know, you click on a link, and what that means is somebody saw the photo cell, you know, sent out a signal. Maybe somebody had to bring you the right thing, load it into the side of your desk, it rolls into the reader, and up pops the thing.
He invented the University of Washington Library, except you're the person with the cart, right?
Yes. And he says it's, he says what this will lead to is wholly new forms of encyclopedias, you know, limited to a, you know, he means limited to a trade and indexed any way you want it.
Right.
Basically a database, although again, not a word yet. And a new profession of trailblazers. He predicts that this will be a job. There will be an information economy of people who are good at, you know, he predicts computer science, basically.
So what is his life? Is he married? Does he go home at night and listen to the radio? Like, where is he in space and time?
Yeah, I mean, he's just an academic. You know, this all came out of being the head of the engineering department at MIT. He wears bow ties. He's got a wife and two sons, and
he's talking about this over the dinner table.
Yeah, and I think he had been thinking about the Memex. By the way, he never says in the article or anywhere else I can find what Memex stands for, but it's kind of implied that it's the memory extender, maybe, or expander, that your brain is no longer what's in your head. It's in your brain plus all this stuff in your desk.
And it's a codex, except a Memex.
And you are kind of infused into it. Like, you are now, your memory, there's an overlap between your memory and your desk's contents. And he cements that by thinking a lot about what the user interface would be. You know, he talks about how you're going to have a keyboard and a series of levers. And, you know, depending on how far you jerk the lever over, it'll jump either 10 pages or 100 pages. By the way, this is the same people are using that interface exactly, to listen to podcasts, to watch Netflix.
Well, he's also inventing
the Google Books,
the cyborg.
Yeah,
because these are people that that the machine and they become a single unit.
And he never grapples with that. Like he never grapples with what. You know, he says he, to him, this is just an amazing convenience. Like he's created, you know, an artificial limb or a pair of glasses or something. You know, he never really stops to think, wait, if this fundamentally changes the brain, what does this do to the people who are using it? And this is something we are starting to think about today for the first time.
Now, does he conceive of this as women's work? Because my experience of this generation of people imagining this stuff, then they also think of it as, at some level, secretarial work, which they, you know, the early days of computers, a lot of the computer programmers were women,
right?
Because the men that were building and buying the stuff were like, well, it's a typewriter, isn't it?
You're punching holes in cards and putting them in order.
And so you see all those pictures of the early days, and this is kind of how my mom got into it, which is just like, oh, well, you know, women, I guess.
The article is entirely ungendered for the most part. He, you know, he uses he as his generic program. But this is funny. Like he predicts this. He talks about, you know, once machines can do arithmetic and logic, he says, such machines will have enormous appetites. One of them will take instructions and data from a whole room full of girls armed with simple keyboard punches.
There it is. Of course.
And he's very modern. Of course, we'll just have I'm very egalitarian. Yeah. A room of women will run this, will serve this great warring machine.
It liberates them from the kitchen.
Exactly. And you won't need the kitchen in you either, because that'll have all the labor-saving devices. Anyway, so his work on, so he writes this article, which kind of waves its hands and creates the information age without the technology to do so, but just because he is a very far thinking man.
And it's a smart enough idea, and he describes it well enough that the Atlantic editors feel like this is something for every tweed suited person in America.
And even more than that, it catches on to the degree that Life reprints it in a slightly abridged version that fall in September. So this is now on the other side of Hiroshima.
Right.
Maybe.
Oh boy.
But nobody makes the connection. I mean, today we can look back and see, hey, look, the thing that he invented turned out to be just as ominous and just as much of a double-edged sword as atomic power.
Yeah.
We've seen the surveillance, results. We've seen the, you know, every downside of the internet.
Yeah. Right. The utopia
societal breakdown. But he doesn't appear to recognize that. But what happens is it appears in Life with a nice new illustration of what the memex might look like, you know, because this is, again, even for a more dumbed down middle class audience, you know, imagine if your home had this amazing desk. And at the time, a young man named Douglas Engelbart, who is shipping, he's a radar tech in the Army, I think he's shipping out of San Francisco. And while he is on his way to the Pacific, the war ends.
The novel 1984 was published in 48 or 49. So
yeah, written in 48, published in 49.
So this is like, it's either in the water or Orwell read this article in Life magazine. Right. I mean, it's not direct, but you know, everybody's thinking about,
I'm trying to think how forward thinking is the tech in 1984. I mean, we associate it with, gloomy technical dystopias of Terry Gilliam movies and Ridley Scott TV commercials. But let's see, how much of that is in the book? There's a surveillance, right? And there are giant screens. Oh, no, wait. Maybe you just see paintings of Big Brother and his Semitic enemy.
Well, I guess I'm thinking of the filmic representation of it. And he's always on a screen. He's always talking on a screen. It's not just pictures.
Are there? Yeah, I think there are big screens. I don't know. Yeah, it's interesting. Like, I could, if you told me that the dystopia of 1984 was just filing cabinets and not actually very science fiction-y.
Yeah,
I might believe it.
There's telescreen. Is that
what they say?
They say telescreen. So,
but yeah, it would have been clear by then that television was the future, and that's true of Fahrenheit 451 as well.
Yeah, right. Exactly.
Anyway, so this Douglas Engelbart on his carrier to the Pacific. He winds up in the Philippines during the occupation, and he is on the remote island of Leyte on, it's not clear where, but in ends of the earth, basically. He's in a bamboo hut with stilts, and the hut next door to where he's stationed at his radar job has a Red Cross library, and the Red Cross library gets Life magazine. And Douglas Engelbart is a young, technical-minded man, and he reads this abridged version of As We May Think, which has now been filtered down from, you know, the highest levels of Manhattan Project scientific elitism down to the Atlantic, down to Life, with pictures, and he sees it all. He's like, this is exactly what I've been thinking of. This is what the future is going to be. And so after the war, when he gets home, he chooses, unlike all his peers, not to go into AI. You know, everybody kind of thought that was the way, this is the way of the future. How do we get computers to be so good that they're like people? And instead he thinks that's the wrong question. That's premature. What we need to do is how do we get people to operate the computers better? Like, he thought that Bush was asking the right questions. And so he starts a research lab, which ends up basically in creating the 20th century. Most famously, it's user interface stuff. Like, he creates the mouse. His lab creates the precursor to the GUI, the graphical user interface, the windowing environment that we're all used to on computers today.
This is the mother of all press conferences or whatever.
What do you mean? The Bush paper or Bush or Engelbart reading Bush's paper?
The whatever that the demo was in 1968, where all these things were shown.
Oh, yes, yes, yes. Yeah, yeah.
The mother of all demos, I guess it's called.
And I guess his lab also, as a result, I think, of Bush's influence, his lab led to hypertext and networked computers. And I guess he's more famous for the user interface stuff, but Engelbart and his associates were equally foundational in creating everything about what makes the internet and the World Wide Web work today. You know, Steve Wozniak said, they call him the Woz, not the Woes.
Yeah.
That'd be weird. Steve Wozniak said, yeah, Engelbart basically created the computer age. And so it all starts there in this little bamboo hut in the Philippines, where he reads about Bush's desk and thinks, this is exactly right. And although Bush didn't have the tech to do it, Engelbart kept at it as the trends that Bush predicted all happened one after another, miniaturization and so forth. And he made it happen.
Wow.
But it was predicted in the Atlantic in 1945.
And that concludes the Memex, entry 774.EX3607, certificate number 18461 in the omnibus. Futurelings, in the unlikely event that social media still exists in your era, more and more unlikely every minute of every day. And in fact, social media no longer exists in my era. So I may be the Atlantic Magazine test case.
You're the American scholar opting out and going out into the woods.
I am. I'm in the woods now. But you can still find our output archived at Omnibus Project. And Ken is still tweeting hilariously and full of insight and information at Ken Jennings.
I would say I'm mostly tweeting quiz show promotion.
Quiz show promotion.
That's what people want.
I have a...
Every night around 7, I tweet, New Jeopardy just dropped. Just got to let people know.
I have a new Patreon where I am doing weird long-form writing and other stuff that I used to awkwardly try to shoehorn into social media, and now am awkwardly trying to reinvent the blog over at patreon.com/John Roderick. Omnibus has a fantastic Patreon that supports the show.
That you now mention second.
I'm sorry. It's the first time I've ever mentioned mine. The Omnibus Patreon has actual tiers where at different levels of contribution, you actually get real physical material, real opportunity to talk to Ken and I via Zoom, actual perks. And that is at patreon.com/omnibusproject. And You can Gmail us, which is really what it is.
Is that a verb?
You can Gmail us at the Omnibus Project.
We skipped F-mail.
Oh.
We went right from email to Gmail.
We went to Gmail.
As a culture.
The Omnibus Project at gmail.com. And you can, and there are lots of fan groups around the Futureling community, most prominently on Facebook and Reddit, Discord. Just search for the Futureling's name wherever fan groups are sold. And you can mail us actual physical items because we exist in
meat space.
Yeah, meat space, spatial time. Here at P.O. Box 55744, Shoreline, Washington, 98155. And those sounds you hear in the background are Ken opening the mail.
It's very complicated. This mail said it said fragile on it, and then there was a picture of a leg lamp. So I guess it said fragile.
Mm-hmm.
So Monica has sent us... Monica said she has watched Jeopardy since 1963 and has never missed an Alex Trebek episode of the show.
Whoa.
That would be over 8,000 Jeopardies, Monica. That's insane.
Wow, Monica.
I guess if you had a VCR in 1984 and kept going.
Well, what?
Because nobody can be home every night at whenever Jeopardy comes on.
Well, wasn't Jeopardy at the time just a weekly show?
No, it was always daily. In the 60s, it was usually an afternoon show.
But in the 80s, it was on every day? It's like Price is Right?
It's been on every weekday since 1984.
At what time?
It varies with your market. Here in Seattle, 7:30.
P.M.
New York and L.A. 7.
I mean, it's possible. People watch the evening news every day.
I guess. Every single day for 40 years?
I mean, I don't know.
Congratulations, Monica.
Pretty amazing.
She's a beekeeper, so she has sent us... I don't know what she sent us. Look, here's one that says, to John, be gentle. So I don't want to toss it to you.
Okay.
I don't know if mine is the same.
Where does she live?
Near the Minnesota Arboretum. She says if we're ever at Paisley Park, she's right down the road. I've never been to Paisley Park. I'm unwrapping my...
So she's an... Is it apiarist?
Apiarist?
Apiarist? All right. Well, let me see. This thing that you won't toss to me requires that I get up. Oh, boy!
Well, I just opened mine, and I can't tell what it is. It looks like maybe the...
It looks like a microphone.
The thing that Steely Dan was named after?
Okay. Oh, I thought that was a stripy t-shirt like you might get if you were in the Russian Navy, but it's really just wrapping paper.
It does look like the Hamburglar in wrapping paper form.
Okay. I have to. It's actually poked through the plastic.
She sent us some honey from her bees.
Oh, I love honey. There's a little typewritten sort of fortune here. Oh, it says ray guns for playtime. They are made with fish floats, earrings, a Coro necklace and bracelet, skull beads, crystals, trim, chainmail, and a DiNicola pen.
It's really good.
Sound effects not included. Check out my website for more fun art. Does she tell us what her website is? Oh, look at this. It's very 10,000 Leagues Under the Sea. Boo, 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 boo.
Yeah, it's a really... It's not steampunk-y. It's really glammed
boo.
Out.
It's also kind of dangerous.
She also sent a little briefcase. Hey, this is Memex-related. It says the complete works of Shakespeare. And when you open it up, it has all the letters of the alphabet and says some assembly required.
Well, we are 10,000 monkeys in 10,000 typewriters.
It appears that this version of the selected works of Shakespeare could not have punctuation.
Oh.
Or any numbers.
Well, does it have capital numbers. Letters? Is it the E.E. Cummings version?
It's going to be all... The letters are different sizes, confusingly. So the C, F, H, K, N, O, Q, S, W, and Y will be smaller than the other letters as you read your,
oh, that's
your lines.
This has got to be some kind of code we're meant to interpret.
MonicaTheGreat.com is where she... make stuff. This is really great stuff, Monica. Thank you for sending us your art.
Are our laser guns the same? Yours seems to be pretty... No, they're not.
Mine is spiky on the back.
Spiky on the back, and mine is ornate.
She also must make some kind of a clothespins, because she just sent us... Are these clothespins? What are
she
these?
She makes clothespins.
She makes clothespins.
Say it five times.
I love... That's one of my favorite... Rolling Stones psychedelic songs. Oh, no, her grandpa made these clothespins in 1945, and he made the machine that made them. But did he make the machine that made that machine?
They are not spring-loaded clothes pins. They're the old-fashioned kind that are just...
They rely on the natural springiness of wood. This seems like an ad we're doing for a new company that will send you the right number of organic clothespins every month that rely on the natural springiness of wood.
So my mom grew up in a home where they, you know, they had, they manually washed their clothes with some kind of washboard and plunger. And then her job in the winter was to, well, in the summer too, but was to take the clothes out and pin them to a wire. And she said in the winter in Ohio, they would, the clothes would freeze, and then they would go out and hit the clothes, the frozen clothes, with a hammer or a paddle and knock the ice off. And that was how you dried your clothes in the winter.
Monica is so multi-talented. She sent us some rocks she painted like bees. Looks like maybe blown glass candy corn. What is going on here? Booby pins, which are like, what, thumb, little decorative earring type thumbtacks with nipples painted on them.
So you're meant to put them, instead of googly eyes, you're meant to put them as boobs.
Finally, googly boobs. Equal time. And... oh, this says, it's a little box that says, there are times when the eye's in your brain, and when you open it, you see maybe Ed Asner as Gandalf, and it says, stare back at you.
That is Ed Asner?
No, it's just an old bearded guru type. This is remarkable. And then postcards. Thank you for the multi-talented Monica for sending us.
Yeah, what an incredible care package.
It's remarkable. So yeah, don't feel like you have to send us 20 handcrafted things, but you could.
You could.
I just don't want the barrier to entry to be so high that people just stop sending you their grandpa's flask from the trenches.
Well, that's the thing. We initially started this because I wanted people's old sunglasses, but now it has become like a real like treasure trove. But we also get an awful lot of postcards and
there's still
Christmas
more stuff
cards.
I didn't see. Here's bottle caps that say you're not worthy.
All right.
Here's some kind
I
of a ceramic
in my mind.
Duck with a tassel. Here is a kind of a mosaic cupcake with a foot. Oh, it's on a chain.
A mosaic cupcake with a foot.
You've never heard anyone say that before? Do you think if I Googled mosaic cupcake with a foot, how many hits do you think there will be? Right,
go ahead and do it.
Nope, zero. This is the first mosaic cupcake with a foot in history. Because if you look for mosaic cupcake,
there are those.
There are 3,100 results. But by adding the foot, Monica has really advanced the field. This is beautiful art. Thank you, Monica. Have you? Are you waiting for me to say something? You said the email address.
Oh, I think I said all the things.
Usually we end with a Patreon, but now that it's a footnote to yours, it comes earlier in the read.
Let's do that again. Omnibus Project. No, patreon.com/omnibusproject is where you help support the Omnibus Project with your generous contribution.
And get cool stuff.
And get very cool stuff, including show notes and... envelopes that have our DNA on them.
A bonus episode a month.
Sometimes a bonus episode a month, which is always great, where we cover the addenda. People write in and say, actually, we should call it the actually episode.
That's actually a pretty good name.
Yeah. And then we beat back your incursions into our thinking.
Into our expertise.
Also, at some level, you might get to interact with Mindy Jennings, who is truly the brains behind this operation.
And it's probably her DNA. I don't think you and I are not licking the envelopes.
No, I've never licked an envelope. Not in your life? Not since 1992.
Were you aware when you licked your last one? Is it like, do you have like a chip or a pin for how long it's been since you licked your last envelope?
I think that's maybe not true. I worked as a clerk in a stock brokerage until 1994, and I think I was licking envelopes then. When would I have licked my last envelope? Who knows?
Listeners, from our vantage point in your distant past, we have no idea how long our civilization survived. We hope and pray that the catastrophe we fear may never come. But if the worst comes soon, this recording, like all our recordings, may be our final word. But if providence allows, we hope to be back with you soon for another entry in the Omnibus.